Hi, welcome to this podcast about concurrency parallelism in .NET. I'm Steve Bjork, Chief Architect at MindTouch.
And I'm Arne Klassen, Senior Developer at MindTouch. Our topic today will be coordinating access to shared data. We'll talk about some approaches, problems, solutions, various ways of dealing with it. There was the traditional way that everybody learns it in .NET and probably any language that does multi-threading. And that is, well, if two threads need to modify data or one modifies and the other that reads it, there really should be something that limits the access to that. You need to lock it down. And so in .NET, the simplest way is just lock the class that you're in, or you're locking some dedicated lock object just so that you know that nobody else can get in there and make modification to that. Now that concurrency and parallelism are kind of getting further into the forefront and we're actually dealing with multi-core systems and all these things, it seems that the traditional of just, hey, lock the object is falling out of favor. And the question for me was, why is it falling out of favor? Because it seemed like a good idea. And was it just wrong in the first place? Or was it just something that worked well for single processor and now doesn't work as well anymore?
Yes, I think we have in the past few years especially, but already before, seen multi-threaded programming really explode on the scene. It used to be that, you know, your application would have a handful of threads, and isolating access to data structures wasn't all that hard. And so if you got it wrong, so maybe you were locking too much. So if you got it wrong on that side, getting it wrong on the other side has all different kinds of implications. But if you're locking too much, your application wouldn't be able to perform at maximum throughput. But it was like, you know, with a single core and so on, and it wasn't that all that noticeable. Now, if you didn't lock enough, of course, the problem is you either run into inconsistency of your data or corruption. So that problem will be there. In the past, you may have gotten away with it because it was less likely to happen since you had less threads and less cores, but now suddenly it's a much more common problem. So overlocking, I think, is probably the biggest scourge currently in multi-threaded programming. And it's unfortunately the pattern for most programming languages in the, like C# or Java, where you create your locks, either critical section, mutexes, semaphores, on a given resource. You take the lock and you perform all your operations. And then later on, when you run it in a production test environment, you suddenly realize, like, wow, why is my CPU not maxing out? Or one of my CPUs not maxing out. And so you start looking at it and you realize, oh, wait, yes, it's because really only one CPU ever at a time can actually make progress because I'm locking a very fundamental data structure. For example, I remember a talk at Microsoft. The thread scheduler was not able to schedule more than one thread system-wide at a time. So if one thread was basically being descheduled to have another one scheduled for your application, no other thread in the entire system could go into that transition, even though you may have four cores, and therefore you could actually do this operation four times in parallel.
Yeah.
So that huge bottleneck. So
it was
really
just not visible before because we didn't have all the cores. So it's like, oh, this works perfectly.
Yes, exactly. It was only later on when we came, started coming. It was actually late 90s, early 2000s that you had these various machines with 16 CPUs and so on, but they were expensive machines.
Yeah.
Now, of course, nowadays, our laptops are dual core or quad core soon. So everybody is running around with, would be running into this exact problem. So it becomes much more manifest.
So generally, when there has been a problem with performance, you go, well, we'll just let Moore's Law take care of it. But with parallelism, it's actually quite the opposite. The more cores we get, the worse this problem gets, because speed isn't an issue in it anymore. It's all these processing units that could do work that are prevented because they're all waiting around for a resource to become available.
Yeah, and there's actually a law, Amdahl's Law, which specifies that the maximum speed up you can hope to get by having a concurrent workload is really limited by your best case sequential work item. I mean, that's what's going to be your bottleneck.
Yeah.
Because if you can't have more parallelism, doesn't matter if you add more cores, they just won't be idling around anyway. So .NET shipped from the beginning with the ability of locking on every object. That's actually the monitor object underneath. Very, very fast, single process locking mechanism. Another very popular locking object is auto reset event and manual reset event.
These
little guys are actually can really introduce some incredible performance constraints. On the surface, they seem to be doing exactly what you want. But even doing a wait one on a manual reset event that is set is very, very slow. And the reason is these guys are actually tied to an operating system level resource. So it isn't just like checking a variable in memory with an atomic instruction. It is really a cross-application operating system boundary call. And it shows up very quickly in profiling that you're spending a lot of time doing this very simple check on something that is actually set. So in .NET 4, I read recently, they added lighter versions of it, which are really mostly wrappers around monitor, because people didn't take to monitor as well, having a completely different name, so they call it auto reset event slim and so on. But that's something to keep in mind. Semaphore auto reset event and manual reset event, if they're put into a tight loop, they can have by themselves huge implications in performance.
Yeah, it's definitely something I wasn't aware of. I always thought that they were actually the faster way of doing it, instead of doing locking on objects. Like, oh, I'll just use an auto reset event. That way I can coordinate all these threads to start processing again while they're waiting for a resource to be completed, especially in kind of the producer-consumer model. Anytime you go and like Google run for examples, I'm like, oh, I want to build a producer-consumer model. Most of the time, everybody talks about, use auto reset event or use a manual reset event, and that's how you can coordinate your producers and your consumers to work. But it sounds like that's actually a very expensive way of having your threads coordinate.
Yes, it definitely is. Another issue I've run into early on with auto reset event was, and then we added a rendezvous event to MindTouch Stream, our concurrency library that is pretty much the foundation for MindTouch 2009 and core, our commercial applications. And the problem was, if you pulse an auto reset event and then you say wait one, the wait one won't see it. There's no counting of how many pulses have gone on. So you say pulse one specifically. The issue being, you wanted to get independence of if the producer produces before the consumer consumes, or the consumer asks to consume before the producer has produced. Let's face it, in a coordination scenario, that's a very common problem. You know, I'm giving you the handle to my inbox, and then I say, hey, when a message arrives, let me know. And in this case, it's a single message. I know this is just used for exactly one exchange, so we don't want something as heavy as a real like queue with eventing and everything, because you're producing a single result that needs to wake me up. And it's possible that by the time I get around to say, hey, wake me up when there's a message, you have already deposited your message, or vice versa. Well, doing that out of the box, there wasn't actually a good object in the .NET framework. So we added one in Dream called Rendezvous Event. And it's very, very lightweight implementation, doing compare exchange, simply checking if either a value has been deposited or a delegate has been linked up for the continuation triggering. And that's actually the foundation of a lot of the coordination that we do internally.
Yeah.
But that wasn't there in the framework, and it seems like a very basic essential pattern. I don't know if it has been added now in .NET 4.0. I suspect it has, but I'm only guessing.
And kind of the compare an exchange, that is part of the foundation of various lock-free data structures, right?
Yeah, so Rendezvous itself is a lock-free data structure because it uses compare exchange. So at the CPU level, you have, even monitor uses it. It's the compare exchange or just exchange or atomic add or system threading interlocked is what the methods are for doing these kinds of operations. And rendezvous event uses the compare exchange. So it checks if it's in one state or another and then does the right thing. You can then take that pattern of doing something like in this atomic transition and start applying it to other situations. And that's where you really start going into lock-free programming or non-blocking. So there's actually a difference there, but let's start with lock-free. So lock-free simply says, don't ever take a lock. Why is that nice? That means that even if multiple threads are running through this exact same code path, working on the exact same data, 10 threads can make progress simultaneously. Now, making progress simultaneously has different implications depending on the nature of the lock-free algorithm. The best lock-free algorithms are actually called non-blocking. The reason they're called non-blocking is because they always complete in O of 1. So it's a finite sequence of operation that will be run. There's no iteration or looping in case the operation failed. Just it goes through and it always succeeds. You're going to get, you know, your contention at the cache level and the CPU and things like that. So, but that you can't avoid. I mean, the only thing to make non-blocking algorithms even faster is by not sharing data. I mean, that's the only solution.
Right. Like,
so just avoid the problem altogether. So, but non-blocking is there are very few of them that fall in that category. Mostly lock-free fall in the category where they will try to do a compare exchange operation on a piece of data. And if it fails, they'll try again, and they'll try again, and they'll try again. So you may have 10 out of the 10 threads that are trying to update the data structure, one is always guaranteed to succeed and make progress. But 9 might be there in a situation where they didn't fail and then try again. So you have a lot of contention. And so when you look at your performance monitor, you will see that all your CPUs are maxed out, but your application isn't necessarily having better throughput. And that's on the quality of the lock-free algorithm that you have. Something between non-blocking and lock-free, sometimes it's possible to have something like fix-up. So, for example, if you look at the lock-free queue implementation in MyTouch Dream, you will see that one of the scenarios, I think it's the NQ scenario, it will attempt to update the tail pointer for the newly enqueued item, and it doesn't check if it was successful or not. It uses a compare exchange operation,
yes,
to make sure that it doesn't set an invalid value. But if it's not able to update the value, it is not cause for failure. It still succeeds, and the reason is when the reader comes along, the one who dequeues, it will check if for that inconsistency in the data structure, and then update the pointer automatically. And again, it will do that in a non-repeatable fashion, because it's like either it moves it forward or somebody else has already moved it forward. So although your data structure is in an incorrect state, it knows how to fix itself up as others come through its enqueue and dequeue paths. So at the end of the day, it doesn't matter. You can't construct an experiment by running these methods that will show you an incorrect outcome.
Right.
But then the nice thing is you don't have this looping going on to make sure the data structure is in this perfect state.
Right.
So now you can see how, like, debugging these kinds of things and so on are it's a nightmare. As you well know, since you helped me find one of the bugs.
Right. It's definitely a more complicated approach to a problem that you just normally go, oh, the easy way is just to incur a lock. Because I remember last year when I was working on the publish-subscribe functionality inside of Dream, I had the problem that, well, this is actually sort of veering off onto another topic we'll talk about later, which is the thread pool, where messages were coming in, and I wanted to just dispatch multiplex messages and dispatch them, and I was going to just stuff them into the thread pool and just say, well, I'll use the thread pool for my queuing, and you work it out, because they could be paralyzed. There wasn't any contention there. But it was horribly slow. So instead, I introduced a blocking queue into Dream, since for some reason .NET doesn't come with a blocking queue. And it seemed to me, at least, that that is a fairly fundamental, simple data structure that you would want to have, that you want to have a thread-safe queue that you can use. And I instituted just having a worker thread that sat on the blocking queue and just fed off of it. And it meant that if you wanted to have multiple processes, you'd have to have multiple workers off of that queue, which is all lovely and fine for that isolated scenario, but we then had multiple copies of the publish-subscribe system, and they then each had more workers, and then when you started hitting breakpoints and looking around, you saw all these idle threads that were just going, I'm just sitting here, just taking up memory, waiting for data to arrive.
Exactly, yes.
And so at that point, we started looking at, well, we need to fix this problem with the thread pool, because we shouldn't be having dedicated threads. We should be doing it on demand. When there is work, get a worker. And when there isn't work, then the worker should be able to go somewhere else and help. And that's, I think, when you really got into bringing lock-free data structures outside of Rondo invent, but actually more complex data structures like queues and lists and everything into Dream, so that we would be able to do these things in a much faster manner than having to do locking on resources.
Yes, that was the goal. And it was much inspired by the work also that the .NET team is doing with their new thread pool implementation in .NET 4.0. Ours borrows many of the traits and maybe a little bit less sophistication, but the nice thing is it's available today in a very permissive license, Apache 2. And yes, the goal was very much to, okay, how can we make sure that this data can flow as freely through the system with as little contention as possible? And when there is contention, let's make sure that progress can be made very, very quickly, because failing to obtain a lock can be incredibly expensive. Now, obtaining a lock is, underneath the covers, a very involved operation. It's not for the faint of heart, actually. First of all, the implementation differs if you have single-core, multi-core machines. Because in a single core, you know that it's impossible for anybody else to even hope to release this thread if, while you have the core, see that it's being locked by somebody else.
Right.
So you have to deschedule the thread. Descheduling the thread is a very expensive operation. There's a reason why it should always be done by the CPU, not proactively. I mean, going in and saying sleep zero all the time, it's not going to make your program faster. But if you're in a single core scenario, I mean, there's no hope. So in a multi-core scenario, however, they found out that, well, maybe this is a very short-lived lock, right? And I just came, I looked at it, and if I just so much as blinked, the next time the lock would be gone. So in multi-core, they actually do a spin wait. So they will spin around a little bit and like, okay, let me wait a few cycles. See, I'm just going to like decrement the integer from 1,000 to zero or from some number, and then we're going to look again. I'm going to do that a few times in a row. If I still fail, then I'm going to start. Only then will I start sleeping and see if I can get it. And if I still can't, then I'm going to decommission myself entirely. So that's actually the spin lock. I think in the case of the regular lock, it will actually not, as soon as it would go into this sleep zero phase or sleep 100 millisecond phase, it actually queues itself up for activation. So what you have to imagine, so first determine, okay, am I single core, multi-core? Great, so I'm multi-core. Okay, so let me do a couple of busy waits and see if the object changes state. If not, then go actually into an active sleep state where you get woken up when the event gets set. That's not simple. Yeah. That's pretty expensive all around. But, you know, it makes sense. That's locking. So you want to avoid that as much as possible.
Right.
And lock phrase gives you that. There's some big drawbacks with locking. So in Mantis Dream, we now have, I believe, four data structures that qualifies lock phrase. The stack, the queue, the priority queue, which really builds on top of the queue. It's a fixed priority queue, so you have to tell it by priorities will never be greater than 8, so you have 0 to 7 slots, and each of them is a queue. So it's a very, very simple implementation. And the most beautiful one, in my opinion, is the lock-free work-stealing queue, which may have been renamed to lock-free work-stealing deck, as in double-ended queue,
right,
which is based on a research paper, and it's just an awesome algorithm because it's actually non-blocking. It's not just lock-free, it's actually non-blocking. So that is the foundation for our new thread pool. It ensures that when an item gets enqueued or when an item gets stolen from another thread, all these operations happen in entire lock-free fashion, and they happen in an O of one time fashion. So 10 threads can go at it, and they will either succeed or some of them won't be able to steal because of contention reasons, but none of them will go into a looping phase where they can't make progress because they're trying to get this variable set to a certain value. So I think the sort of what we have now is going to serve us pretty well for the foreseeable future, and I can't really foresee how we can improve upon it.
But basically, it does mean that, while lock-free is the faster and preferable method, it isn't really... Or the theory behind lock-free isn't necessarily a solution to a lot of ways that we've traditionally been doing locking. Because usually when we think about locking, it's really, I want to block everybody else from access to this field. And there is no such thing as just a lock-free lock, I guess, because it wouldn't actually even make sense. So the complexity of turning your object and changing its data access strategy to be lock-free isn't as simple of, oh, we have a different algorithm that we can replace the lock statement with. It really is a different way of thinking about your data, and it does add a lot of complexity. And I guess that's probably the biggest drawback to approaching it that way.
Yes, I 100% agree with that. The if you just want to get an idea of how crazy lock-free data structures can become, even specialized one like, you know, stack and queue, these are the simplest ones you can imagine, actually. But just go read up on the double-linked list, lock-free. It's pages of algorithms, because while you're trying to insert a single node in a given place and, you know, update your next pointers and your previous pointers and update their next and previous pointers respectively to point back into you, you have to realize that the neighboring nodes may be being added and removed dynamically at the exact same moment, and then neighboring nodes can be removed in a moment. So there's a lot of this error-fixing code in there that tries to recover the data structure and make sure that the next person who comes and does something doesn't perceive wrong data and what have you. You have a very awesome clock right there.
Yes, didn't think about that one. I was trying to eliminate all the different sources of sound, and then... back to the double-linked list.
Yeah, so in the case of the thread pool, for example, where the thread pool uses almost exclusively lock-free data structures. So it uses multiple of them, and since it doesn't use a lock to coordinate between them, it is absolutely the case that it is possible that a given thread at a given moment is in a situation where if it had done it in a more atomic fashion, it would have gotten an item. But in this case, it missed it. Because it looked in the two places sequentially, and of course something inserted itself right in between. So first I look in my bucket A, which is my local queue for dispatching items, and then I look in the master queue, and something gets forced to cracks. And similar when a new item comes in through the master queue. So what we have there is we actually have a timer that kicks in 10 to 20 times per second, depending on configuration, and checks if, is there something that could be dispatched that hasn't been dispatched? Because if a thread doesn't have anything, it puts itself into the idle queue, right? So it's possible to have an item in your in queue and have a thread on the idle stack. And so the timer comes in and basically fixes that up and says, hey, we have a thread, we have an item, great, let's party. But you need that, because you can't guarantee that the sequence of operation will yield always the right outcome. But you can fix things up again.
Yeah.
It's a very different way of approaching the problem, and certainly not applicable to every scenario.
No. And certainly not a solution to many of the traditional ways that people are used to locking. It does require some rethinking of data access.
Correct. Yes. No, it's like when you add security to a system like ACL or something. Trying to patch it on top of an existing system tends not to work very well.
Yes.
You really have to build it from the ground up to have it that way. Now, there are some other interesting techniques that have come up over the previous years, like software transacted memory.
Yeah, it's definitely... I've seen it being mentioned more and more. It used to be that you just heard about it in research. There seems to be some implementations that are being used over in the Java community. I haven't really followed up what their story really is, whether it is production ready or what kind of... compromises they have come up with, because it is a fairly complex problem to solve without constantly locking up your data structures and just saying, I'm sorry, the transaction works by locking it, which basically then you're right back to where it used to be. So it'd be interesting to take a closer look at that.
Yeah, the end game for STMs, or software transacted memory, is the same thing as with, if you will, lock-free data structures, and that is multiple threads can make progress on a given instance simultaneously. I mean, that's really the key, because with locks, we fundamentally deny us that opportunity.
Right.
We would have to create finer-grained locks if you wanted to be able to update various parts of the object simultaneously of an instance. And if you have finer-grained locks, you run into the issue with acquiring the locks in the right order. First of all, so you have the cost of acquiring multiple locks, but heavens forbid that somebody comes in and acquires them in the wrong order. For example, let's say you do a wider update. So you get log A and then log B and you do your update. While you're doing that, somebody else comes in and needs to only update the part that is on the log B. So I call log B. And then in the middle of it decides, oh, wait, I need to call this other method to do some additional work, and doesn't realize that that method relies on acquiring log A. Well, it's never going to get log A
right
until the other guy comes out. So if these guys happen to have intermingled themselves in the wrong order, so you got the B log, then the AB guy comes in, gets his A, doesn't get to the B part, and you come in and you try to acquire another. It's just... It's game over. It's a complete deadlock in your system, and unless you put timeouts in there, which are highly recommended always, in my opinion, nobody should ever write any code without timeouts on acquiring logs.
The whole lack of timeout pretty much is a single-threaded mindset where you go, well, I'm asking it to do it. It will do it eventually. The moment you go across multiple processes, there's no guarantee that anything you do or that you ask someone else to do for you does return. So, yeah, I mean, we see it more in more complex scenarios of concurrency where you're actually going out of process across machine boundaries, right? That at that point, you really have to have it. But and people usually think of like, well, we'll do a network timeout. But it does apply just as well for just in your same process across multiple threads. You have the same issues that you might see in distributed computing as well. So timeouts are just one of those kind of things that we'll probably see become much more of a fundamental signature of method calls between objects, just because we can't guarantee that you're going to get a result back and not block forever.
Yes, and it might not be because of you. It might be it is calling something else, or it may be calling something else. And the question is, you know, well, what would you rather have? A program that is entirely deadlocked? And that needs to be restarted, because that's the only possibility. You can't abort a thread that fundamentally ruins your .NET runtime consistency, may very well corrupt it, and it's just badness all around. And I think also the behavior was changed, that if you try to abort a thread, it's considered an uncatchable exception now, and it just fail fast, yeah, or just immediately terminates your application. That might be all good and nice when you're running client-side software, where the person can just click, you know, quit application and restart. Server-side applications, not so good. If they will just accumulate this deadlocked pairs of threads, and suddenly you're using up all your memory, and it's like, what's going on? So having the ability of saying, okay, well, shit happened, what can I do about it? Okay, right. it's like the thing I called throw an exception or something. Let me unwind my stuff and let me get out of here. I think that kind of defensive programming, especially in multi-threaded scenarios, on the server side, you can't avoid.
So we've talked quite a bit about the complexities and pitfalls and just problems that you run into dealing with shared data. And there's a couple of topics that we'll probably cover in the future podcasts, which basically say, well, just don't do that. I mean, one of the fundamental ways of not having to worry about lock-free or locks is that you don't share data with anybody, but you have other strategies of coordinating different work that everybody has their own copy of the data. And so a couple of these things that we're probably going to get into is message passing, where you just hand them off all the data and you might have your own copy, but you don't affect the data that someone else has, or going into more functional aspects where you're dealing with immutability of objects, where you once you set the value, you cannot change it. So if you want a changed version, you have to create yourself a new copy and things like that.
And then another one we have spoken together is also journaling, which is basically, if you think about it, a specialized application of software transacted memory.
True.
I mean, it's instead of saying we're going to solve it every instance, it's just a little bit like in a lock-free case, it's going to say, no, we're going to create a journaled class. In our case, we want to do it on the creation of XML documents. So XML documents, when being passed around, not need to be copied to avoid this issue with different threads modifying the data structure and then bad things happening. But at the same time, you don't want to have the cost of copying all the time. So I think so we're running out, slowly out of time here, and we don't want to make this too long. To recap, when it comes to locks, there are certain best practices, and that is try to be as granular with your logs as possible, but don't be too granular. try to find the smallest possible lock you can get away without having to resort continuously to taking multiple locks, because this will be error-prone and lead to deadlocks if you have to work with locks, which is still, unfortunately, a reality, unless, like we're going to talk next time or one after that, about message passing, which actually gets around a lot of the complexities that have to that come around with multiple locks. Look also at lock-free data structures, especially if you actually working with, you know, you need a queue or a stack, and that's the only thing that you're taking a lock on. You can entirely get rid of that. So, of course, again, if you have multiple things that need to be changed, be careful that you make sure that your data can be, if it is inconsistent, it can become consistent again. And you certainly can take, you know, you can use lock-free data structure in a in the locked case as well. It just seems to duplicate effort.
Right.
But you will not run into any of their contention scenarios. I mean, lock-free data structure tend to be slow and under contention. If they're in a locked section, then there's no contention by definition. But it may make certain things easier, where sometimes you just need to update the lock-free data structure, and other times you need to update multiple things. So in the latter case, you take a lock that contains a lock-free data structure. That's perfectly fine. And for .NET 4.0, make sure to look out for the, if you do not need coordination locking across processes, use monitor or use the newer classes being introduced that have the slim suffix. They have much, much less overhead. So I think that's kind of the top recaps I remembered.
Yeah, I think that covers everything. And if you're interested in lock-free data structures, there's certainly lots of research papers that you can Google for, or you can take a look at Dream, since that's kind of our place for putting all this code in as we're working with it. So, A, it's there for your use in .NET, and B, well, you can poke around the code to see how this is actually done.
Great.
All right.
Well, guys, if you have any suggestions on topics you want us to have covered or questions, please post comments once it is published, and suggest topics for next time, or anything else you'd like us to cover. So thanks for listening in. Until next time.
Thank you.